You ever have one of those flights where the weather just will not cooperate? Where every system on the airplane starts acting like it has a personal grudge against you? Now multiply that by 8 helicopters, a secret airstrip in the middle of the Iranian desert, and 52 American hostages counting on you to bring them home. I'm Taildragger, and this is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because this one still stings. Today is April 24th. And on this date in 1980, the United States launched one of the most ambitious rescue missions in military aviation history. They called it Operation Eagle Claw, and before the sun came up over the Iranian desert, 8 Americans were dead, 5 helicopters were wrecked or abandoned, and the world was watching the wreckage burn on live television. But here's what most people don't know. That disaster in the desert changed everything about how America flies special operations. Every night stalker pilot, every tilt rotor crew, every special operations helicopter unit flying, today traces its DNA back to the ashes of a place called Desert One. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So let's go back. November 4, 1979. Iranian militants storm the United States Embassy in Tehran and take 66 Americans hostage. 14 are eventually released, but 52 remain. Diplomatic efforts go nowhere. President Carter authorizes a military rescue, and the planning falls to a joint task force under Army Major General James Vaught, with Colonel Charlie Beckwith commanding the ground element. Beckwith was the founder of Delta Force Hard as Coffin Nails. That man, he'd been building Delta specifically for missions like this.
The plan was staggeringly complex. 8 RH-53D Sea Stallion helicopters would launch from the aircraft carrier USS Nimitz in the Arabian Sea. They'd fly roughly 600 nautical miles at low level across the Iranian desert to a remote staging area designated Desert One there. They'd rendezvous with 6 C-130 Hercules transports carrying Delta Force operators, rangers, fuel, and equipment. The helicopters would refuel, the assault team would load up, and they'd fly on to a mountain hideout near Tehran. The next night, they'd hit the embassy compound, extract the hostages, and fly them out to a captured Iranian airfield where C-141 Starlifters would be waiting. On paper, it was audacious but workable. In the air, it became a nightmare. The 8 Sea Stallions launched from the Nimitz on the evening of April 24th. Almost immediately, the crews flew into a haboob. Now, if you've never seen one, a haboob is a massive wall of suspended dust and sand that can stretch for miles in every direction. This wasn't a sandstorm with wind and fury. This was something worse. It was a fine talcum powder suspension of particles hanging in still air. Visibility dropped to near zero. The helicopters had no terrain following radar. They were flying on basic instruments and conditions. Those instruments were never designed to handle. Imagine sitting in the left seat of a Sea Stallion, a big twin-engine helicopter designed for Navy minesweeping, not desert infiltration. You're flying at 200 feet above the desert floor at 120 knots. You cannot see the ground. You cannot see the helicopter in front of you. Your artificial horizon is telling you one thing, and your inner ear is telling you something else. The fine dust is getting into everything, into the engines, into the hydraulics, into the cockpit, and you're maintaining radio silence, because the entire mission depends on nobody knowing you're there.
Helicopter number 6 was the first to go, about 2 hours into the flight. The crew got a blade inspection method warning light. The BIM system monitors the pressurization of the rotor blades. If a blade loses pressurization, it could be cracking, and a cracked rotor blade at 120 knots means you're dead. The crew landed in the desert, confirmed they couldn't fix it, and was picked up by another helicopter. 7 birds remaining. Now here's where it gets interesting. The mission planners had determined that 6 helicopters was the minimum needed to carry the assault force and hostages. 8 were launched to provide a margin. Lose 1, you still have 7. Lose 2, you're at the bare minimum. Lose 3, and the mission is a no-go. Helicopter number 5 was next, deep in the haboob. The crew lost several flight instruments. The gyroscope, the key instrument for flying in zero visibility, became unreliable. The aircraft commander made the agonizing decision to turn back to the Nimitz. 600 miles back through the same dust cloud he'd just come through, he made it. But now they were down to 6, exactly the minimum. The remaining 6 helicopters eventually straggled into Desert One over the course of about 90 minutes. They were late. The timeline was already shredded, and the site itself was not the empty patch of desert they'd been promised. A bus carrying 44 Iranian civilians had been stopped on a road that bisected the landing zone. A fuel truck had been hit with an anti-tank rocket when it refused to stop. There were fires, there were detained civilians, and the clock was ticking. Then the mechanics found the real problem. Helicopter number 2 had a hydraulic failure in its secondary system. The primary system was still working, but the backup was gone.
Flying a Sea Stallion into a hostile city at night with no hydraulic redundancy was something nobody was willing to sign off on. Colonel Beckwith and the on-scene commander agreed. They were down to 5 flyable helicopters, one below minimum.
Beckwith got on the satellite radio to General Vaught. Vaught called Washington. The decision went all the way to President Carter, and Carter, to his credit, did not hesitate. He aborted. Now comes the part that haunts everyone who was there. The helicopters needed to reposition to let the C-130s take off. Desert One was chaos. Helicopters and Hercules aircraft packed onto a narrow strip of hard desert, engines running, dust swirling everywhere, everyone exhausted and frustrated and trying to get out before dawn gave them away. Helicopter number 3, piloted by Major Jim Schaefer, needed to move to clear a path for one of the C-130s. In the brownout conditions, the swirling dust kicked up by the rotor wash, Schaefer's Sea Stallion drifted left and settled onto the wing root of a C-130 tanker. The 130 was callsigned Republic 5. It was loaded with fuel bladders and Delta Force operators. The impact ruptured the fuel bladders. Both aircraft erupted in a fireball that lit up the desert for miles. 5 Air Force crew members in the Hercules and 3 Marines in the helicopter were killed instantly. The fire was so intense that ammunition began cooking off. The remaining aircraft had to evacuate immediately. They left behind the burning wreckage. They left behind the 5 intact helicopters. They left behind classified documents, maps, and mission plans that the Iranians would later parade in front of cameras. And they left behind 8 flag-draped coffins worth of failure. The aftermath was devastating. The hostages wouldn't come home for another 264 days. The images of burned American aircraft in the Iranian desert became a symbol of national humiliation. Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, who had opposed the mission, resigned. An investigation commission led by Admiral James Holloway produced a report that was brutal in its honesty. The Holloway report identified what went wrong, and almost all of it came down to one word: jointness, or rather, the total lack of it. The helicopter pilots were Navy and Marine Corps aviators who had never trained for this kind of mission. The C-130 crews were Air Force. The ground force was Army, Delta, and Rangers. They had different communication systems, different terminology, different command structures. They'd barely trained together. The helicopter pilots had gotten minimal desert training and almost no practice flying in degraded visual conditions. The mission had been compartmentalized so tightly for security that the left hand genuinely did not know what the right hand was doing. And the helicopters themselves were wrong for the job. The RH-53D was a minesweeping helicopter. A good machine for what it was built for, but it was maintenance heavy. It didn't have the avionics for low-level desert penetration, and the Navy had pulled them from operational squadrons without telling the squadron commanders why. Some of those birds hadn't been properly maintained because nobody knew they were about to fly the most important mission of the Cold War. But here's what rose from those ashes. And this is why I think every pilot, military or civilian, should know this story. Within months, the Army stood up Task Force 160. It would become the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, the Night Stalkers. Their motto is "Night Stalkers Don't Quit," and they earned every letter of it in blood. These were pilots selected specifically for the mission. They would fly the most demanding profiles in the world, low level, at night, in weather, with absolute precision. They would train together constantly. They would maintain their own aircraft to their own standards. And they would never ever go into a mission with crews who hadn't rehearsed together until the operation was muscle memory. The failure at Desert One also led directly to the Goldwater-Nichols Act of 1986, which completely restructured the American military's command system. It broke down the walls between the services. It created the United States Special Operations Command. It ensured that the next time a joint force went into harm's way, they would actually be joint. And the helicopters changed too. The MH-60 Black Hawk and MH-47 Chinook variants developed for special operations are among the most sophisticated rotorcraft ever built. Terrain-following radar, forward-looking infrared, integrated defensive systems, in-flight refueling capability. Every one of those upgrades exists because 8 men died in the desert when the technology and the training weren't good enough. You know, I think about those helicopter crews a lot. Those Navy and Marine pilots flying into that haboob with nothing but basic gauges and guts. They weren't cowards. The investigation made that clear. They were brave men asked to do something they hadn't been properly trained or equipped for, in an aircraft that wasn't up to the task, under a command structure that couldn't adapt when the plan started falling apart. And I think there's a lesson in there that goes beyond military operations. Every accident, every incident, every close call in aviation is a link in a chain. At Desert One, the chain was forged from inadequate training, wrong equipment, poor inter-service communication, and a plan so complex that it had almost no tolerance for the kind of friction that real-world operations always produce. The desert doesn't care about your timeline. The weather doesn't read your operations order. The 8 men who died at Desert One were Major Richard Bakke, Major Harold Lewis Jr., Technical Sergeant Joel Mayo, Captain Lynn McIntosh, Captain Charles McMillan II,
Sergeant John Harvey, Staff Sergeant Dewey Johnson, and Marine Sergeant Major. Their names are on a memorial at the Special Operations Command headquarters at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa. And every Night Stalker pilot who straps into a Black Hawk or Chinook today carries their legacy forward. This story was drawn primarily from Mark Bowden's work on the Iran hostage crisis, the Holloway Commission report, and the official histories of the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment. If you want to go deeper, those are the places to start. Find more at radiohangar.com. Fly safe out there, and remember, every procedure we have was written by somebody who learned the hard way.